Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're still going through content. And I know how frustrating the mind of Americans, you know, operate. I know how everybody really wants to talk about the current events of what's happening, but I can't impress upon you how important it is to understand. If you're Christian, I think everybody understands the importance of understanding the scriptures, understanding the commandments, understanding God's law and what we need to be doing. And I cannot emphasize enough how important it is to understand this Constitution, because clearly every single framer, as a matter of fact, the one time Congress was unanimous in calling for a day of fast and prayer was when they asked George Washington. They sought George Washington to set aside one day for a thanksgiving to the Lord in fasting, praying, and sanctifying the Constitution. So, in other words, folks, when we really look at what Thanksgiving is all about and what Thanksgiving is supposed to be, which is why I will cover George Washington's proclamation of Thanksgiving, and you'll see that it was not a feast. It was not a point in time of gluttony. It was a time of sanctifying this nation and sanctifying the Constitution. And the reason I'm kind of, you know, going off on this little tangent, because, you know, Paul's here, and welcome back, Paul.
Hey, thanks.
So this coming Friday, I'm going to dive into the, you know, the importance of the Constitution, and actually why I don't do and dive into the current news cycle. You know, it's easy. Go, if you want entertainment, if you really want to know what's going on and you don't understand, then by all means, go tune in to these people that are getting paid really well to entertain you, to actually keep you preoccupied on the world that's falling apart. But what's really more important is that we focus on what we have to do. I cannot tell you how important your county elections are. Everybody is all baked into this national election that the president can save America. And I am here telling everybody that only you can save America. And no, you can't plan and actually hope that somebody else is going to do it. You have to do it. As I remember one of the profound songs I heard a long, long time ago, wishing won't make it so. Praying won't do it. Hoping won't do it. Religion won't do it. Philosophy won't do it. And that leaves you. You'll have to do it. Because it is literally upon both of our shoulders, or all of our shoulders. We all have to contribute. And if we do, and every step that we take and every action that we make, there's no doubt in my mind, the Lord will bless us. We will succeed. He wants us to succeed. And so those of you who are actually out doing some of this stuff, you know, because I have the privilege and opportunity of hearing people doing this stuff, I'll just say there's a level of spiritual awakening happening with these folks. And so there's no doubt in my mind that they're understanding, yes, this is really what we have to do. Not a logical sense, in a spiritual sense. We actually have to take this Constitution back, and we have to take our representation back, which is why your county commissioners, your county supervisors, you need to be in their grill, you need to be challenging them, and you need to basically, you know, do a public relations campaign against them if they're not going to support the Constitution and demand that whoever sits in that seat and stands in that position will become your guardian of the Constitution and actually, you know, go after your state and federal government. And I'm just saying this, folks, because I think that if our counties are resolved in supporting the Constitution, you'll be protected from the state. You'll be protected from the federal government. So with that, Paul, welcome back.
Hey, thank you. I want to add something. I think the proclamation you're talking about, the Thanksgiving proclamation, I think it was providential just because it seems like the Lord puts the right people in the right place at the right time. And Congress had such a respect for Washington. And Washington had such a surprise and respect for the Constitution and what it was able to do, that I think the timing was right. Imagine a unanimous request for a proclamation from Washington. You know, that's something that I don't think has ever happened in history. And it's something that we should have some regard for and pay attention to.
Yeah, right. And so there's a lot, so Washington was really humble, and he was a very humble man, and he didn't know in many ways what to say regarding his responses. So I'm not sure if you knew this, but Madison wrote most of the correspondence back and forth from Congress to the White House, White House to Congress.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
What was he? Was he the, because Jefferson was Secretary of State. Who was Madison?
Madison, well, he was a representative in the House of Representatives. And he was the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And so, I mean, that's why we read the cod fishery bounties. I mean, Madison, right. You know, he commanded respect, which is why we went through the Assumption Acts. And why Madison really was, you know, he was livid when he finally found out that the Assumption Acts gave Hamilton the justification for creating a national bank.
Right.
And that's when they realized this guy was devious beyond Patrick Henry.
Wow. Okay. The creature.
Yeah, the creature. That's right. So anyway, because actually they even referred to the federal government as the creature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the Constitution created that creature. Anyway.
Right.
Anyway, so we're right now in Article 4 of the Constitution, which means we're kind of on the very back end of the meat of the Constitution, ready to fly into the amendment. So it's going to happen kind of quickly, but we started with Article 4 yesterday. And this is where, you know, we kind of covered the full faith and credit being given in each state to the public acts, records, judicial proceedings, and so forth. And then we kind of came around and started talking about the citizens of each state. This is where we left off, that the citizens of each state be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. And so this is where reciprocity exists. And this is the whole fundamental premise, that if you have a right to carry a gun, a concealed weapon, every state in the union has to recognize your right based on your state of origin.
So these, correct, which means that states are violating the Constitution by, how should I say, it's unequal representation. Maybe that's not the right word, but they have specific reciprocity agreements that don't take into account Section 2 of Article 4.
Yes, and so remember the young man, Rittenhour. Rittenhour, okay. But you know what I'm talking about. He was a teenager who had the right in Wisconsin to have that weapon. That was a legitimate weapon in the state of Wisconsin. And so he took it to Minnesota.
Right.
And he ended up getting into a scuffle, and he ended up, you know, unfortunately killing a person because that person tried to threaten his life, trying to use some form of force, which could have easily escalated into the loss of his own life. And he ended up having to make the difficult decision to use his weapon. And right. So everybody wanted, and, you know, the people thought, oh, well, he was at least guilty because in the state of Minnesota, you can't have, he was too young to have that weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was then, never. That
and
was
by the way, he took a weapon across state lines, right?
Right. Well, yeah, but it doesn't mean you can't do that. And the whole point is the reason that those charges, you know, may have been floated in the public opinion, but why those mm-hmm. charges had actually no traction whatsoever, and they may have actually been on the case, they were instantly dismissed because of the constitutionality or the unconstitutionality of the charges. Doesn't okay. mean that he wasn't charged. It's just that
right.
there, you know, he had this immunity.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. And so what is that? It says the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states because of the Constitution.
Okay,
so the next one, go ahead. This is where we kind of actually we covered these two, right?
Yeah, we actually covered.
We didn't cover this one in detail enough. So go ahead and let's just read, you know, this right here, and then
you mean no person held in service.
Yes, no.
Yeah,
the person, a person charged in any state. We didn't dive into this. Go ahead.
We read it, but we didn't dive into it.
Right.
A person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime, who shall flee from justice and be found in another state, shall, on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled, be delivered up to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime.
Okay.
Okay.
So what does this mean?
Well, it means that if a person is fleeing justice in one state, that that state can request extradition from another, correct?
Yes. Okay. And, well, now, so hold on here. They don't have to flee. All they have to do is be charged and not found in the state.
Ah, okay. So they could be outside of the state and still be have extradition requested.
Right. So give me a case. So give me a case where this would really play well in the hands of the patriots and in the hands of a constitutional government without, I don't want to poison the pool here. I don't want
to,
you know.
No, you don't have to poison the pool. Okay. This one's easy for me.
Okay.
Okay. The name that immediately came to mind is Bill Gates.
Okay. Now, so I'm not sure if he's fleed from the state of Washington.
But imagine the people in the state of Montana, right?
Uh-huh.
Who, you know, where they have a right to a to a clean environment?
Uh-huh.
Right? And Bill Gates admits that he wants to block the sun, all right? And yep. And has the money to do that, by the way.
Yeah.
All right. Wouldn't they be able to charge him? Okay, he doesn't live in Montana, but wouldn't they be able to charge him and have him extradited? Am I taking a difficult choice? I'm just
No. So it's not that they probably couldn't do this, and it's not that they probably couldn't, because all they'd have to do is link his, you know, him financially or any other way to paying for sortie missions of chemtrails going over their state or going, you know, near their state to where those chemtrails, by prevailing winds, drifted across the state, then they could actually call, you know, charge him with that crime because it's occurring within their jurisdiction. Right,
it's so within their jurisdiction. So something he's done, or something that anyone's done, that is a crime that's occurring in the jurisdiction because of this person's actions.
Right, right, right. But you're missing the big one. You're missing the big reason why I'm highlighting this.
Okay.
Okay, now let's look in context to Republic Review.
All right.
So now can you think of a case where Article 4, Section 2, Subsection 2, becomes a real play with Republic Review? So, folks, we haven't gotten into Republic Review. I've talked about it before. The information is out on the website. Republic Review is where the states are initiating the audit against the Constitution and the federal government. Republic Review, when they're actually initiating and executing Republic Review, they're holding the government responsible. Now, when we talk about holding the government responsible, who are we talking about? Are we talking about the president? No.
We're talking about anyone who's...
We're not talking about the president. No, we're not talking about Congress. We're not talking about the Supreme Court or the president. See, folks, we have a Republican form of government, and the sovereigns in the federal government is Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is how Republic Review will go down. When the governor and the state legislature and the attorney general have all committed to fully supporting the Constitution and demanding full compliance. And let's just look at Texas. Now, Governor Abbott is not the guy that'll fully support the Constitution. This guy's got an agenda. I know he's a hero to a lot of people that get sucked into myopic issues like the invasion. But here's a guy that supports the Constitutional Convention. He supports all sorts of things that are not constitutional and or is, you know, one of those guys that wants to urinate on our Constitution instead of restoring our constitutional order. So just using Texas as an example, it's a big state. And Texas has lots of good representatives in Congress. But they have some really bad representatives, too. And so when Texas actually gets on full board and we actually have enough states, let's just, it's 27 states based on my count right now. Now, we'll find out in 2024 where we are, but right now it's 27 states and these are the reddest states in the union right now. And so when we look at these reddest states, there are lots of Democrats that actually represent, you know, I'll just say a congressional district in these states. So when these states actually now have the control over this much of Congress and they send a directive to Congress to actually just shut down the Department of Education, shut it down. Here's, you know, here's the directive, and this is how we want you to do this. We want all documentation. We want all emails. We want everything personal, memos, everything to be, you know, seized and basically encapsulated so that we can go through the evidence and find out, you know, who was actually doing evil things. But you know, what they do is they create this directive of how they want everything to be secured and how everything is to be shut down. When Congress, and they basically say, we want you to do this immediately. And so they will basically call upon, you know, their representatives to do this. And any representative that refuses to follow this directive, what does that mean?
It means that they are violating
their oath. That's right. So they're violating their oath of office. And so what they're actually committing is a crime. And so they're perjuring themselves. And in accordance with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, they are to be removed. So technically, the state can actually convict a person, a congressperson, a Democrat, or a Republican who refuses, that is currently in office, they can convict and remove that person from office without having to deal with Congress. The supreme law of the land demands this. And so, therefore, the state, the governor and the attorney general would come up with the charge to basically say this person has been found guilty, must be removed. And so right there, Article 4, Section 2, Subsection 2 then comes into play. That person to be charged, because then what they will do is they will extradite that person for felony charges of how they've committed this insurrection against the Constitution and will face trial in the state of Texas. Wow. And so they will extradite that person and at the same time replace that person with somebody that will actually support the Constitution. I am telling
you. Well, sure, because.
Go ahead.
Because that person is probably in Washington, D.C. They're not in the state, but then they get extradited.
And they think they're immune. They think that they're immune, that the state can't do anything to them. And they don't. See, folks, this is why understanding the Constitution is so important. And these guys think that they're above the law, when right here the law says that they're not. And when they've been found guilty and they're not residing in that state, they can immediately be extradited, and they have no choice. Now I think Congress will try to protect some of these folks, but you got to remember that at this point in time, we've cleaned up a lot of these little bastions to where, at this point in time, the Republicans will be in charge.
Well, I think Congress, well, when you say Congress may try to protect some of these folks.
Yes, may try to, yes.
Think of this for a minute, okay? This is states, but let's say they're hiding out in the District of Columbia, which is not a state.
Yeah.
Okay, so so we are, full faith and credit shall be given in each state. And a person, let's see, who shall flee from justice to be found in another state, okay, that's not the District of Columbia.
No, but there are U.S. Marshals that have the extradition authority to remove anybody from Congress and return them back to the state. Doesn't matter where they go. Extradition orders from a state is, the reciprocity actually goes into D.C. as well.
Yeah. Okay. So when you just brought up something, because you've got, and I don't know where to deal with this, so maybe we should bookmark it. But you just mentioned U.S. Marshals. Now we've talked about police. We've talked about the FBI. But I don't know where U.S. Marshals fit into this.
Well, so if you read the Whiskey Rebellion, they actually created U.S. Marshals, who were the ones that actually worked at the state level in enforcing tax laws.
Huh.
Yeah.
So not the militia?
No. So, let's just say enforcing from the willing participants, those who were willing to pay. But if there was a real revolt against paying taxes, that would require the militia. But the U.S. Marshal usually worked with a local authority like the sheriff or what have you throughout an area, region of the state and so forth. And basically make sure that those excise taxes were captured. Because, see, excise taxes are not a tax that is given to the state directly for apportionment. That's not the direct tax. An excise tax is an added tax on a consumption of a product or what have you. And they usually place that tax on the manufacturing, right? That's why the whiskey manufacturers had to actually pay the tax. And how the whiskey manufacturers, the larger you were, the less the tax was.
Okay.
In other words, so, the way they implemented it, it really wasn't fair.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't want to stray, but when you mentioned U.S. Marshals, which is a police force, it just triggered the question.
No. So
where are they constituted?
Yeah, so we just ran out of time, as you probably can see on the clock. Yeah, so we just stumbled into a break, folks. So when we come back, I want to close on this, because a U.S. Marshal is somebody that actually does the extraditions and so forth as well, because there are some federal crimes, which is why we actually see counterfeiting falling under the U.S. Marshal, and we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me kind of close on this, Paul. When we look at treason itself, let's say somebody has been charged of treason by the federal government, because the federal government would then have jurisdiction over that federal treason. It's right. Clear that states can actually do this as well, and they can hold their own people to treason against their own constitution, their own laws, and so forth. And so the state does have the ability, but the federal government does have cognizance. And so when that person's arrested, the U.S. Marshal will extradite and, you know, basically, let's say chaperone or accompany or escort that individual to the federal court and turn him over to the, you know, the local in processing into their incarceration system. With, you know, if it's a joint state, county, federal court, you know, in jail or what have you, right? So anyway, so the U.S. Marshal, I don't see as an entity that is not constitutional. It's just like the General Accounting Office. You know, you got to have somebody that's actually making sure that there's pens and paper for Congress to write notes if they want to write notes.
Okay.
Or chairs if they want to sit down. They got to buy the property. They got to maintain the properties. And anyway, so
all right. So U.S. Marshal is an office to act in pursuance of the Constitution.
Yeah, and actually, the U.S. Marshals, I don't know if they fell under the Treasury. I think they probably fell under the Treasury.
Okay.
For enforcing tax collection of taxes and so forth. And so they had this kind of dual role. But anyway, yeah, so the U.S. Marshal should then escort your representative, your Democratic representative, out of D.C. back to the state to face charges while the state's replacement goes into Congress and actually does the job.
Right.
Because it's not about a one-time vote when it comes to Republic Review. It is about the federal government submitting to the political force of the states.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're the parties in the compact.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
So now we can do the one that's been replaced by the 13th Amendment.
Sure. And that is... No person held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall in consequence of any law or regulation therein be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. This is modified by the 13th Amendment. This was pretty much what was the substance of fugitive slave laws, correct?
Yes.
We did cover this a little bit because one of the things that I pointed out that I observed was that there were some states that just didn't pay attention to this. You know, northern states, they didn't support it. And so GR, they were violating the Constitution.
Well, so yes, there were some states that felt that the moral obligation of individual freedom, that all men were created equal, superseded the Constitution. So, in other words, there were states that were founded on the same principles and arguments that Madison had in the Constitutional Convention, and most of the men in the Constitutional Convention. You know, it was, like I said, you know, the political compromises created in the Constitution only were temporary. That these men knew that slavery would come to an end. Mm-hmm. That based on the way the changes that were already afoot in America, that the abolition movement and the lack of the growth of slavery would be the death. It would be a slow death, but it would still be the death of slavery. The problem was that they didn't want to create a federal government that had that much power over the state.
Right. Okay. Here's an off-the-wall question. How much do you think, what effect do you think the invention of the cotton gin had to do with extending slavery?
Most people think that that was the real reason why slavery was extended. But that's not true. That's not true at all. Because look at what happened in, you know, before 1820. The cotton gin and the production of cotton and all of that, you know, even though that was this, you know, I'll just say a big industry for America, the production of cotton. Even by 1820, the pressures were coming where they realized that slavery was slipping through their hands. They couldn't stop it. They needed a political victory to basically put the eradication of slavery at bay, which is what they did with the Missouri Compromise. They basically bought up Congress and, you know, the opinions of the courts to allow this Missouri Compromise to inflict slavery upon all of these states across a geographical line.
So what happened is that the die was cast for a violent change when it could have been avoided.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. The die was cast that said, you know, because they used a corrupt method and basically successfully gained this coercion of states, because that's what they were doing. They were using coercion to force states or compelling states into slavery. Yeah.
Correct. Okay. All right.
All right. So now Section 3.
Okay.
Article 4, Section 3.
New states may be admitted by Congress into this union. Is that a typo in the Constitution?
So hold on.
New states...
You know what? It might be. I think that there is a typo in this, possibly. Let's take a look. Because I'm going to Article 4, and because I found actually typos in the Avalon Project. Okay, new states may be admitted. So actually, that was probably a typo done by me. So that protect, just delete. New states may be admitted by Congress into this union.
There we go. Okay. New states may be admitted by Congress into this union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of the Congress.
Okay,
now,
so...
You've got a couple things highlighted here.
Yeah. So actually... I believe that because there were so many, because the orange is originally John Rowland's mark. In other words, John Rowland felt that what they did with some of the states was just wrong. And, you know, in the admitting process, I believe that what they did, and because you got to remember, John Rowland in 1990 looked at, you know, this control of land as a problem, but he didn't see the control of land as that bad of a problem. So let me submit to you, because I truly believe that that should be red with yellow text instead of just red with black text or orange with black text, because orange is less severe than red. Okay. And I believe that when we look at the economic warfare, because in 1990, the federal government wasn't really conducting warfare wholesale. They started controlling the logging industry. And as they started doing that, the logging industry and those who tended to the forest at the state level said, hey, because my grandpa was one of them. My grandpa was in the logging industry in Oregon. And okay. He basically, because I remember him saying this, that they told the federal government, if they're going to manage the forest the way they're proposing, we're going to have really bad wildfires.
Mm-hmm.
Was he a prophet in, you know, making that assertion? No. They knew that if you allowed the forest to go untended and, you know, get undergrowth and get disease and all of these other things, and you're not going to tend to that, then you have the recipe for really bad wildfires.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we literally today, you can see a stark contrast between a federal forest and a state-maintained forest that's using lumbering and so forth. And yeah, you'll sure. actually see, you know, a part of a mountain or several mountains that have no trees on them to what you see, but there are lots of seedlings because every time they harvest timber, they go in and plant more trees.
Yeah, I got to tell you something. When we lived for a while in Idaho, and the northern border was on the other, the Oregon border was just on the other side of the Snake River. Like we were three farms away from the Oregon border. And I remember watching the hills on fire.
Yep.
Okay. Which yep. is a very weird thing to see.
Yes.
And so it's, and I don't remember whether or not that was federally controlled land. I know that there was no one on it. And it is eerie to see the hills on fire. It's just, you know, something, like you say, something wasn't done right. And like you say, they didn't have to be a prophet to know that land not managed properly is going to feel the effects of nature.
Yep, yep, yep. All of that. But so here's what we really need to talk about.
Okay.
Now that you've read this one clause, this first paragraph of Section 3, anywhere in there where the federal government is granted any authority to actually change the stature, the power, the footing of a state in joining the union. In other words, did they have any authority granted to them to reserve all the, because remember, a state is a sovereign, independent entity. They were creating mm-hmm. independent sovereign states.
Correct.
Anywhere in here that the federal government was granted any authority to hold back any state resources from the state. In other words, placing a burden upon the state to say, you can't have these resources because they're too valuable to us.
None whatever.
None whatever.
Yeah, that authority isn't there.
That authority has not been delegated. In other words, the concept of equal footing, which was initiated when new states were joining, and they actually created that as a doctrine, that mm-hmm. all states were to become equal parties to this compact in joining the union. They would have right. equal footing, that they would have all access to all of their resources.
Correct.
And now we see that what they had been doing from Indiana on into Missouri and so forth was all unconstitutional. In other words, the burdens that they started placing on these states and or making them slave states, taking away natural resources like salt mines and basically dictating to the states what to do with these things, you know, and it got worse and worse as we started adding more and more states to the union to where, and you pointed this out, if anybody looks at the federal lands controlled within states, you'll see a map that is absolutely staggering to see how much of the western states is considered federal property. Now, some of that federal property, such as military bombing ranges and things like that, that's legitimate stuff. Mm-hmm. Because we need to have military training in, you know, dropping bombs and so forth. Okay. But that's it. That is it. Indian reservations or reservations for trees or endangered species or environmental protection areas, sanctuaries, whatever you want to call these things. They're all unconstitutional. Nowhere in here does it say that the federal government would be able to have any authority outside of the things enumerated in this Constitution to possess and manage land for any purpose, even an Indian reservation.
Did you? I heard you mention that this started with Indiana?
Yes.
That early?
Yes. Yeah, they told Indiana that there were so many salt mines within the state, and they basically told them, it wasn't an order, they just said, you can't sell that land because that's a natural resource, and they didn't want. So this actually speaks to, you know, the federal government's responsibility in maintaining and preserving American resources so that they can't be bought out for either business interests or for international interests.
Right. So Indiana became a state in 1816. So yes. That early.
Yes.
I mean, the founders were still living. So uh-huh. When did...
Yes. So Monroe... So if you read the Enabling Act, they didn't take possession of it, which is why Madison was okay with it. Madison was okay with it because it what they basically... They recommended to the state, this was an overstep, but it was still, you know, a gentle overstep. They recommended that the state not sell that land, that they basically, you know, advise them because of its natural resources and importance to the union, that they, if they do anything, that they lease that land to mining companies, but not to sell the land.
I see. So in other words, the feds didn't take over the land.
Correct.
But they recommended to the state to retain it for its mineral value by the state.
Right. So this was the camel's nose in the tent.
Okay.
They didn't take over the tent. They just said, hey, you know, just do this one little thing. And I'm sure Indiana followed that guidance because, yeah, well, that makes sense. Yeah.
Okay, so bear with me, GR. I've got questions, and I imagine that our audience has questions, and so here's a question. Let's take a look at some of these western lands. I mean,
okay,
Idaho and Nevada have significant portions of the land.
Yes.
In fact, I think the majority of Nevada is run by the federal government. So let's say that we go through Republic review, and this land gets released to the state.
Well, now, actually, it doesn't get released to the states. The state takes back the land. I mean,
the state takes back the land.
All claims are dissolved.
Right.
Okay.
So here's a question. So now the state has the land. I guess then it's up to the legislature of each state how that land is dealt with. That makes sense, right?
Yes. So there's one little caveat here.
Okay.
So there's this one classification of land that the federal government has that was really egregious. As far as I'm concerned, I qualify this as domestic abuse. When the federal government created these Indian reservations and then forced the Indians onto that and used all the force and everything else, they were really, and you got to remember that by this point in time, this is after the framers had pretty much stepped out of the fray, because this right. all fell underneath Jackson. So Jackson was the one that actually started violating, you know, this cohabitation. In other words, you know, they didn't have reservations. There may have been somewhat reservations that were being kept and maintained because of Britain, but they were really trying to assimilate. And actually, you probably saw that in the Why Counties Matter Most document.
Okay.
Because I talked about the process of how America's policies towards Indians migrated from one position to the next position to the next position, you know, for over the course of the past 200 years, mm-hmm. 200 plus years. So the fact is that these Indian reservations actually, it should be considered property of the state, or actually not property of the state, property of the Indians. And right. that the Indians, you know, should have the deed to that land.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you know, what should have really happened is when the state joined the Union, that reservation should have actually been surveyed, and it should have been subdivided so that every Indian family that was alive had their own claim, their own land that, you know, they owned.
Right.
And that, you know, the state could tax that, but not take that. So okay. here's the thing. Yeah, it's okay for the state to tax it, but if you can't pay it, then mm-hmm. the state can't collect. That's it.
Okay.
And they cannot have this, they cannot have a law that says if you can't pay your taxes, we can basically take your land. Because the Fifth Amendment actually, you know, protects you from them taking that land.
Without just compensation.
Without just compensation. And oh, by the way, just because you can't pay the taxes doesn't mean you still have to pay those taxes. If they're to take that land, they have to pay you for the full value, not a... Because in many cases today, they don't even pay you. If they take
oh,
your
no, they
land,
don't.
If they so let's just say, you know, one fifth of the value of the land, you know, hasn't been is what you owe in taxes, and they take that land, they don't give you the four fifths. Actually, what they should give you is the full five fifths.
Right.
But because the state wants its pound of flesh, but the whole point of a state government, and the whole point of government in America, is to protect life and property. And the fact mm-hmm. that they can tax and take your property becomes antithetical to the point of government.
Sure.
Which is why every state in the union needs to have it within their constitution that the state cannot take your property. Now, when they talk about they need to qualify your property as your, you know, your personal land, your domicile, where you live. It could be your farm. If you have a farm and you use it to, you know, make money, then mm-hmm. that land is a farm. And so, but if you all of a sudden, you know, get, and this probably would happen in the following generation that would inherit that land, that they say, you know what, I don't want a farm. I think that farming is evil, but I'm living on, I've received this farmland, excuse me. And so mm-hmm. if the new generation comes along and says, we're not going to farm, we're going to let this land go dormant and just actually just become non-productive. I believe that the state, for strategic interest, should be able to actually take that land and lease it so that they give just compensation to the landowner and mm-hmm. actually allow other people to farm on that land.
Mm. Okay.
Because the state does have an interest in it making money off of land that can make money.
Okay. So in other words, it has an interest in its land being productive.
Correct, because the state should be the one that actually is the warehouse of the food for the citizens of the state. So mm-hmm. when we look at this, you know, all the food that's being produced, the state has a responsibility of putting some of that aside in case there's an emergency. Instead right of the now, federal government federal doing that. Thing, right, correct, yes. Correct.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's see how's that worked out.
Yeah, so right? we've kind of wandered, but this, if you look at the Bill of Rights for the 21st Century on the Take Action page, I start actually having these conversations or laying these things out so people can actually start going, you know, what should we do? You know, mm-hmm. government is, you know, it does have a responsibility of protecting our life. Well, if they're not doing something and we could starve to death, then right. it would be a good, it would be the good thing for, we got to make sure the government stays constrained, that they don't mm-hmm. actually become the bully in telling us what to do. But I think, and everybody in the state should all agree that, you know, it's a good thing that, you know, the state has an aggressive, not too energetic, but they do have a good policy that allows, you know, this using of the crops, so a certain percentage of that crops, and not only do you pay the taxes, but a certain percentage the state can use to barter to get other, let's just say you don't have anything but forests. You can't mm-hmm. grow wheat in Idaho. You know, sure. let's say you there's certain crops that you just can't get to put in the stores for the people if bad times befall you. So sure. taking parts of that to exchange with other states to get the necessities for everybody of the state, then there you go.
Okay.
So the state should be kind of the brokers of, you know, maintaining some kind of protection for everybody. Now, my policy, and I believe everybody should actually do that for themselves, but there's lots of mm-hmm. people that can't.
Sure.
And there's nothing wrong. And this is where I think this is where the righteous temporal welfare, or if you want to look at it, compassionate services, this is what we need to do. This is the safety net, you know, to literally keep people alive. But the welfare programs itself actually ought to be dismantled. And that's a totally different subject. Totally okay. different. We've only got 1 minute left in the show, and we still haven't finished Article 4. But my point is, and we'll have to, folks, we're going to have to bring this back up, and we'll start off with Section 3 again, because there's nowhere there in the first paragraph, nowhere, where they were delegated any power whatsoever to take away, to do any of the things that they're doing with your state land, and even siphoning off your production of foods and so forth. Because they did the same thing. They actually took it, and instead of actually, you know, paying for it, they allowed you to deduct that out of the taxes that you had to pay. Mm-hmm. And so the states can do the exact same thing.
Okay.
Okay. So anyway, and then we'll look at, you know, the other part of this, because the other part we want to examine to say, well, maybe they put it in the other part. So when we come back tomorrow, we'll dive into this. Any other shots?
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Awesome.
Good morning to cover.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Paul, for your time. And so we will dive into Article 4 tomorrow. And hopefully I think tomorrow we'll wrap it up, because I think the rest of Article 4 is pretty smooth sailing. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.